People have handed in drafts of the first paper quite early by historic standards. There's no reason to. This is not by way of even a whiff of pressure. There's no reason to hand things in early. In fact, there's all things considered, there's some advantage to letting the course go on to get more of a feel for it before you pick up a particular topic. But I just wanted to remind people that the first paper for the course is due at the end of October, so, 4 weeks from now, roughly. And if you know that you're going to be picking that the topic that you're most interested in writing on is something that we've already covered or will be covering soon, there isn't any reason to wait until just before the due date to hand it in. I think Matt, you handed me one that I haven't yet written comments on because of other matters. I will get comments shortly. And then you'll get comments early and you'll have a chance to rewrite it if you want it. So feel free. This is purely informational. Feel free to write your paper, hand it in earlier if it fits in with your schedule and stuff. Before I begin on today's topic, are there any leftover ideas or issues from the last discussion that anybody sort of would like to bring back to the table? Tatiana and Zhao? One other thing, yes. As I said, you may have forgotten, but as I said at the very beginning of the class, anyone who buys a new copy of books, I get royalties on them. Used copies, I don't. I have as a general principle that professors shouldn't earn money on the side from assigning their own books to students. That's not true for the Real Utopias books, which I don't think any of those were assigned here, because the royalties from the Real Utopias books go into the Real Utopias project. So that seems to me legitimate. So what I'd like anyone who has purchased a new copy of any books that I've written, what you should do basically is, in effect, write me a little invoice. I mean, I don't know what the prices are these days and stuff. But if you put your name and what you spent on the books, then you'll get a rebate. It's like a mail-in rebate. Right? I'll bring a rebate and pay everybody back for the royalties. It's not a lot. You won't get a lunch out of it, but you'll get a cup of coffee out of it.
You don't want receipts?
I trust you all. I mean, if you say you bought this paperback and it cost you $90, I might raise my eyebrows a little, wondering why the publisher's pitiful royalty checks don't reflect this incredibly high price. But what is interrogating inequality selling for? Is the new problem? Does anybody remember?
$30.
$30. What's it say on the back?
I don't remember.
Somebody got Amazon for $5.
There's no price on the edition, so they can change it all the time and keep increasing it.
Well, I suppose it may be print on demand now. It's possible, rather than inventory from the original printing. Probably it's print on demand. It looks like it might be because it looks skinnier than the print on demand. Eventually, it's a pretty good system, and eventually I think the cost structure will be reasonable for it. It's not so much that the technology is new, but the logistics are new for print on demand. So the standard process now is to have a much smaller initial run, and then to have subsequent print on demand, because it's so quick now with modern printing stuff. And for whatever reasons, because of the character of the paper and binding, print-on-demand books are almost always skinnier than the original ones. Yeah, so I'm serious about this. I'm, you know, trying to make a joke of it, but no, really, I feel completely that this is the right way to go. You know, it's 7.5% is what, since none of my books have sold over the $25,000 copy threshold or whatever it is, when the royalties kick up from 7.5% to 10%. And then they go up to 12.5% if you sell 50,000. So far, I don't have any blockbusters out there that have sold that much. So it's 7.5%. So if it's $30, it's $2.50 roughly, something like that. Okay? All right. Bring those in. I'll accumulate them and then come in with the money rather than carry around with me a pocket full of cash and change. But I will pay you back. All right. Today and Monday we'll be dealing with class and gender, and Wednesday with race. Needless to say, each of these would certainly would justify 3 or 4 weeks in a course like this. If the course was a year-long course, as it had been for the first decade or so that I taught this, we indeed did spend 3 weeks on gender and 2 weeks on race, so it was a kind of major block of the course. The purpose here, then, is not going to be to review the complexities of these discussions and the complex relationship between Marxism as an intellectual tradition and contemporary work in feminism or in the analysis of race, but rather to use this as an occasion to explore a number of general problems in class analysis, which can kind of anchor further thinking and reading that you might do. Race and gender are often coupled with class. They're the kind of holy trinity of critical thinking. Sometimes sexual orientation is added to the list, but basically race, class, and gender are sort of the three forms of oppression that get coupled in standard critical left thinking. In the last few decades, or 15, 20 years or so, race and class race and gender have become more central and class less central to the systematic thinking of people around these things. Indeed, one often sees class sort of falling by the wayside. When I began my work and when this course began, class was at the center, and the worry of people who were concerned with gender was that gender was always being subordinated to class. So the way in which this part of the course was framed was in how to think about gender as both an autonomous form of oppression, something that isn't simply reducible or a reflection of class, how to think of it as autonomous and yet systematically interconnected with class. What does that really mean?